ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, it's Lisa Leong from This Working Life, helping to make your work life better with advice from the world's top experts, like psychotherapist Esther Perel.
Many conflicts are about power. Power is when I dismiss what you're bringing up. Power is when I magnify a problem.
And Professor Adam Grant.
We need to take our critics and our cheerleaders and turn them into coaches.
Free coaching! Search for This Working Life on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal land. I'm David Marr. About 60,000 men from the islands were brought to Queensland to cut cane until blackbirding, as they called the trade, was stopped in its tracks at Federation when white Australia came to rule the Commonwealth. Blackbirding has been a subject of grim fascination almost ever since. Officially not slavery, but so close it hardly mattered. Later, a new look at blackbirding. But first,
Australia has done what no good business would ever do, build its entire security around a single partner on that partner's terms. The cost is indefensible. We're talking billions of dollars over the next decade alone. For submarines that we won't receive for decades, built to designs and with technology we don't control, for a strategic purpose that is not entirely our own. And then there's the question of the United States.
Barbara Jackson, concerned citizen of Melbourne, covering most of the bases, addressing Peter Garrett's private public inquiry into AUKUS. The inquiry has already had hearings in Melbourne, Fremantle and Adelaide. The Sydney hearings begin next week. They'll be addressed by the former Foreign Minister Bob Carr and the former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull. Neither are expected to give AUKUS a pat on the back. We're joined by the inquiry's chair, Peter Garrett. Peter, welcome to Late Night Live.
Hi, David.
Now, what is the beast you're riding here? Public-private inquiry?
Well, public in the sense that everybody's welcome, it's transparently done, and it's funded by the public. Private in the sense that it is not a government inquiry, it's actually being conducted by private citizens.
So you can't compel the Prime Minister to attend?
No, that's right. We have none of those opportunities nor powers, but we certainly have, I think, something which is equally important, and that is the opportunity in our democratic polity for people to show up, ask questions and produce submissions for us.
You're the chair. Who's sitting with you?
So I have retired Admiral Chris Barry, former Chief of the Defence Forces. Carmen Lawrence, who many of your listeners will know, former Premier of Western Australia and also a federal member and minister. Karina Lester, the daughter of Aboriginal elder Yami Lester, a Pitjantjatjara elder who was affected by the Maralinga test and lost his sight and became a great advocate for his people at the time. And Leanne Minchell, who is the Chief Executive Officer of the Australia Institute, a solicitor and someone with a background in environment and policy.
So what's the strategy? I mean, do you expect to discover things about the AUKUS project that have not been known before?
Well, we don't expect to, David. We have. But the strategy is pretty straightforward. In the absence of any serious parliamentary inquiry, any really decent and thorough investigation or analysis or presentation of materials around AUKUS, given its size, given its consequence, it seemed prudent for us to basically allow a process which would enable people to learn more about it. It is an inquiry. It's a genuine one. It has the terms of reference, and we're open to all comers.
And there's not been any public discussion from governments of the ins and outs of AUKUS? There's never been a public inquiry before?
Not really. The Senate committee looked at it briefly, but didn't do much with it. There was no cost-benefit analysis produced. We haven't had a commission of any kind. There hasn't been a full debate in the parliament. I mean, when the Joint Strike Fighters were being considered back in the day, well, you and I were still around, some of your listeners probably not, there was a Royal Commission and a commission of inquiry. There wasn't a ministerial statement that was then debated fully in the House and then referred to a committee. And we haven't been provided with...
For AUKUS, you mean?
That's right, for AUKUS. And we haven't been provided, other than an overarching, so to speak, rationale, with any significant amount of material, analysis, research or views on what AUKUS actually is constituted. In fact, we did hear in our hearings that most of the information that initially was made public about AUKUS could be fitted on a couple of foolscap pages.
Let's have the headline information. How much money?
$368 billion.
How many submarines?
Eight.
Delivered when?
In stages, but somewhere between the early 30s through to the mid-50s, 2050s, if at all.
If at all.
That's right.
If the deal doesn't come off, of course we get our money back.
No, we don't.
Fair enough. Now...
Well, look, you're asking the right questions, David, but it is an extraordinary obligation that the Australian government has entered into. And I think it merits us having the inquiry and a fuller public debate. And that is that under the terms of the AUKUS, let's call it a pact,
yep,
we're essentially subsidising the United States and the United Kingdom to beef up their submarine building capacities in order that we might buy three second-hand submarines from the Americans initially, and then, as a yet-to-be-designed or built AUKUS submarine, a bigger nuclear-powered submarine, acquire those in part from the United Kingdom. They would do the reactors and potentially the first full submarine, and the remaining submarines, some four or five, would then arguably be built in shipyards in Australia, particularly in South Australia.
But it all depends in the first instance in upping the rate of production of submarines in the United States, and that seems to be proving tricky.
Yes, and we've heard evidence already, and we'll hear more evidence, I'm sure, from experts who say it's simply not going to happen. And the reason's pretty straightforward. Apart from the vagaries of President Trump in his recent announcement of a sort of a super vessel that he wanted built, I think, in his name.
Yes, the Trump class.
The Trump class. The American shipyards have struggled to get above 1.1 to 1.2 submarines a year, and they need to be much greater than that in terms of their production. By the way, under this deal, we've already paid them billions of dollars. We pay, I think, somewhere in the terms of $4.8 billion each to accelerate their shipbuilding capacity.
But it hasn't worked.
So far it hasn't, and there are serious questions about whether it will. I mean, we'll continue to hear evidence slash, it's not really evidence, but material brought to us on that matter. I think the thing, I've learned a lot about submarines since agreeing to head up this inquiry.
I'll bet you have.
And I don't want to...
If I could just point it out, you're not built like a submariner.
No, I'm not. What's interesting about it is that the more you think about what the deal actually represents, the less inclined you are to believe that it has any merit. We come open-minded in a way because we've got a terms of reference. And I mean, someone like Chris Barry's, you know, very, very experienced in these matters. He's headed up the Defence Force. And all commissioners don't see eye to eye on every matter. Neither have we essentially come to a conclusion about it per se. Yet, everything that we see up to now, in terms of a deeper reflection on what was agreed to initially by Morrison and then when Prime Minister Albanese came into office, essentially straight away by the Labor government, says to us that it's very difficult to see how this can be in Australia's national interest.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr. I'm talking to Peter Garrett, Chair of the Public-Private Inquiry into AUKUS. Peter, tantalisingly, a few minutes ago, you said you had discovered things that you hadn't known, that were not known before about AUKUS. What have you actually discovered?
Look, I think the main thing we've discovered is that there is a whole process underway that is essentially being embarked upon without the full and prior and comprehensive knowledge of the Australian people. And for example, we heard evidence both in Fremantle in West Australia, and the base there is the Stirling base, and also in South Australia, where the base is the Osborne base, that there's already legislation in place which is essentially overriding state-based legislation, planning controls, environmental controls and the like. Now, this is something which I think the people of South Australia and Western Australia had very little idea about. We heard, for example, that there's a significant push into education facilities, into high schools and colleges and so on and so forth, essentially supported or in concert with one of the big weapons manufacturers there, BAE, which is sort of entering into sort of the beginning of informal partnerships within schools to encourage
in what
people,
way, Peter?
Well, to
syllabus?
Well, not straight into the syllabus. This is a question that we've asked ourselves and we've sought more information about that. But what seems to be happening is that on the ground, there's a fairly significant public relations campaign underway, which is designed to try and make AUKUS essentially more palatable and potentially more acceptable to the local population. At the same time, when we had our hearings in Fremantle, we heard from the a former chief medical officer of Perth, a senior Perth bureaucrat, that there was in fact no nuclear safety plan in place around the base of Stirling in the suburb of Rockingham at all. So what we're discovering is a process which I would describe, I find it, I'm really struggling to find the words for it, David, because it's the biggest thing we've ever done as a nation post-war. Certainly the biggest defence expenditure in one single hit that we've ever had. It involves a partnership with two other countries for submarines not yet designed and potentially not delivered. And yet on the ground, there's a lot of activity underway which essentially is preparing the way for something which may not happen. So in that sense, you might say, well, we put the cart before the horse. But in another way, it raises the question of, well, what is the ultimate purpose of AUKUS? Is it really to allow Australians to have potentially 8 nuclear-powered submarines? Or is it really the fact that it fits into the American forward defence posture strategy, and particularly with Stirling, where nuclear-powered and potentially nuclear-armed submarines would start rotating as of 2027, i.e. next year?
Peter, who's talking to you? I mean, are you hearing from the supporters of AUKUS, or is this just a forum for complaint?
No, I don't think it's a forum from complaint, because a lot of the people, David, who've come in, particularly Barbara that we heard earlier on, are really sort of saying, I don't really know what's going on. When I have a look at it from the material that's available, I've got a lot of questions that don't seem to have been answered. But we have heard from some pro-AUKUS senior former ministers, Linda Reynolds, a former defence minister, and Christopher Pyne, also a former defence minister, both coalition ministers and both pro-AUKUS. Now,
Let's listen to a grab from Linda Reynolds.
Sure.
And the stark fact is that China is in its largest military build-up of any nation since 1945. Today they have more than 60 submarines, and by 2035 they will have over 80, and almost half of them will have nuclear propulsion and have nuclear weapons.
Now we'll come back to China, but let's pursue this question of who is talking to you. Who are you hearing from technical experts who say, look, the problems can be solved? Are you hearing from financial experts who say, in the bigger run of things, this, you know, these hundreds of billions of dollars are not too much, etc.?
So the short answer is yes, we are, and we do expect to hear from more of those experts, particularly I think in the Canberra hearings, which will be our concluding hearings in a couple of months' time. The material that's come to us and the submissions that have been made and the presentations from pro-AUKUS parties have been confined mainly to the two former coalition defence ministers. But interestingly, David, Minister Reynolds was very much in favour of AUKUS, but also was very open about the fact that it essentially would make Stirling a nuclear target. That hadn't really been expressed, I don't think, in such an ambiguous language before. Christopher Pyne, who's now an arms lobbyist and was supportive of AUKUS, also made the remark, perhaps typical for Chris, that there's no way it's going to arrive on time or on cost. We have invited the government to present. I've written to the Prime Minister and the Defence Minister twice now, inviting them or officials to come and inform us about AUKUS, but we haven't had any positive response. A number of people who've been coming, there are people very concerned about radioactive waste and how the nuclear radioactive waste would be managed if it were to happen. But we've also had quite a lot of members of the public arriving just to find out what's going on.
Yep, yep. Linda Reynolds talked about China. In the reading you've done, in the research you've done, in the testimony you've heard, has anybody advanced a rationale for AUKUS independent of the notion that we are a target for China?
Not really. I mean, there's some significant issues that we have to dive into when we consider all of the material that's come to us. And we will be hearing, I hope, from foreign policy experts and analysts who have strong views about this and will have thought about it a great deal. I think the thing that probably all commissioners would note now is that we don't see a rationale that's been put forward to support AUKUS as being consistent with what we can see in the region and what others are saying. I mean, the classic example is that China is a major trading partner of ours, and yet the rationale that's advanced for the AUKUS submarines is to protect our trading routes. Now,
yes, but Peter, Japan was a major trading partner of ours in the 1930s.
Well,
didn't protect us.
No, there's an ancillary, but I think equally important question here, and that's the question around the number of submarines. Without getting into the detail of it too much, your listeners should be aware that there is a ratio that applies to having submarines full stop. And it's basically the 3-to-1 ratio. You have one at sea and you have two in dry dock or being repaired in some way. Now, to secure our sea lanes, both through the Indian Ocean and up through the Straits of Malacca into the South China Sea, with two submarines over vast distances is a stretch. Some people, including commentators and foreign policy and defence experts, have simply said the purpose of AUKUS is much more about enhancing and providing capacity for America's defence or offensive obligations in the region that it is around providing the safety of sea lanes for Australia. Now, that's something which we need to test and look at carefully, but that is what we've heard.
Are you hearing evidence that says the undetectability of submarines beneath the sea is guaranteed forever? I mean, when you look at the remarkable things that can now be done even before AI comes into the situation, these huge vessels moving, albeit absolutely silently and at great depths under the water, what makes us think that they are going to remain invisible forever?
Well, it's a really good question, and I don't think anyone actually can answer it, and that's the truth of it. Although you're right, David, to identify that we are operating in a completely different setting. And by the way, AUKUS has got two components to it. It's got Pillar 1, which is the submarines, and Pillar 2, which is cybernetics, drone warfare, asymmetric warfighting, and so on and so forth. Now, some of those things may, in fact, as per your question, be necessary things for a sovereign government in Australia to consider in the future. But on the question of the invisibility or otherwise of the subs, it's an open question, and it seems to be the consensus from what I can see from the material that's come to us so far is it's very likely that they're going to be more easily detectable, to the extent to which is not known. One important thing, though, about the AUKUS submarines is their size. They are massive. They are 10,000-ton submarines. The Virginia is 3,500 tons. I think the Collins sub, which is our Australian domestic submarine, is even smaller than that. And some experts have raised issues around whether they are actually suitable for essentially defending Australia because of the shallow waters to our north.
Right. Let us assume for a moment, because as an independent and carefully balanced chair, you'll be looking at this issue. Let us assume for the moment that everything succeeds, that we get the subs, we don't pay unnecessarily too much money for them, they defend Australia, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What are we going to do with the waste they produce?
Well, that's one of the big issues that's come up, not only from people like the Medical Association for the Prevention of Nuclear War, but also from First Nations people whose lands have always been the subject of planned places to bury and store nuclear waste. The key thing about the AUKUS submarines, again, and I'm talking about the five yet to be designed and built submarines, is that intended that they would use high level of uranium enrichment in their core. Now, some submarines have what's called low levels of radioactive enrichment, but the AUKUS subs produce, so in other words, weapons grade nuclear material. And on the question of the disposal of waste, well, no country has yet. Finland's got something underway, but the Americans have not yet managed to deliver or develop a below ground safe permanent storage facility for their radioactive waste. It's just sitting around in places above ground in drums, and you know, some of the ships are, subs are just rotting. But in Australia, if we were to cost it, it comes in at around about, this is back of the envelope, $150 billion. Which, so add that to the AUKUS cost.
$150 billion to deal with the waste.
Yeah, it would be around that. That comes from the South Australia did a Royal Commission into having a domestic nuclear radioactive waste facility, and that's roughly where we think the figure would end up. But there's a much bigger question here, David, and that is that under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and the Treaty of Rarotonga, of both of which Australia is signatory to, and the Treaty of Rarotonga is in our domestic legislation as well, I think on what we've seen in front of the Commission so far, there are serious questions about whether we would be actually breaching the terms of both of those treaties. The government says not, but I think there's very high risk there.
Now, your Canberra hearings are when?
Our Canberra hearings are in early September.
And that's it for the hearings.
That's
and
right.
Then the writing begins.
That's absolutely right.
And when do you expect to have a report from your investigations?
I'm hoping that we'll have a report by the end of November, if not earlier.
Wow, that's speedy.
Well, we have to be speedy because I think the issue is too important to us spending a lot of time delivering a report which comes in the new year. We've received some incredible information and material from people, and I expect more to come. After all, as you pointed out, we'll have former Prime Minister Turnbull appearing, we'll have former Foreign Minister Carr, and we'll have Admiral Peter Briggs, Australia's foremost submariner, appearing as well. That will give us some additional perspectives. But yeah, we need to get it out quickly and it needs to be readable. So it's going to be a plain Aussie language report, I promise.
All right. Now, you've been many things in your career, including a politician, and you therefore must have considered what political impact a report of this kind can have. Is this just going to be a gesture? Or do you see some possibility of the government changing course on AUKUS?
At the moment, Minister Miles and the Prime Minister and Minister Wong seem very locked in. But I really do believe that once people have a chance to actually absorb what we find, understand that everything that we've found is on the basis of verifiable information that's come to us, which is on the public record, or submissions that people have produced to us. And also take into account some uncertainty I'm now starting to detect in the defence establishment slash, you know, the think tanks and former retired military people who are really looking at, and even those people who are in favour of nuclear-powered submarines, question whether this is the right deal for us. So I'd like to think that there would be some reflection by government. But more importantly, I think there needs to be significant reflection by the public, because this deal will, if it ever comes to fruition, happen long after you or I or any of the sitting prime ministers or foreign ministers are anywhere to be seen. It is a massive, massive amount of money. It's probably going to run into excess of $500 billion. And if it doesn't actually fulfill the purpose of keeping Australia safe, if it doesn't provide us essentially with a security strategy as opposed to a military strategy, then subsequent generations of Australians are going to be scratching their heads and say, how did this happen?
Well, exactly. I mean, why did we sign this deal? Now, this must be part of your inquiry. Do we know why we signed this deal, or do you think you know?
I don't think we fully know yet. There are a couple of differing accounts. The differing accounts come from different players, and I'm doing the little inverted comma sign to you here on radio. So we have former Prime Minister Morrison's version of events. We have former Prime Minister Turnbull's version of events. And we have a couple of sort of analysts and journos who've come with what they think the reason is. And Boris Johnson himself took some credit for it. They just thought they were dudding the French. You know, that's what he said a couple of months ago back or a bit earlier.
Well, it's always worthwhile, isn't it? I mean, go back centuries, dudding the French has always been a huge benefit to the British nations of the world. Yes, go on.
Well, I think the thing is that we don't really still fully know. And I mean, that's the extraordinary thing about it, Dave. And it's irrespective, I think, really, of where you sit along the political spectrum. How is it that a sovereign nation has got itself into a situation where it's basically underwriting the shipbuilding and submarine building capacities of other countries in order that we may or may not receive submarines in the future? There's a capability gap in the middle of all that with a very high price tag on them. We can't give them back, where we have to take care of the radioactive waste, no price tag on that, potentially with high levels of interoperability with American defence facilities and otherwise, and yet we haven't had a public debate about it.
Which you are providing.
That's what we're trying to do.
Peter, thanks so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thanks very much, David.
I've been talking to Peter Garrett, Lead Commissioner, AUKUS Public Inquiry. There will be hearings in Sydney next week and in Canberra in September. Peter, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thanks, David.
Coming up, the slaves who grew Australia's sugar. From the 1840s, men from the islands were being brought to Australia to work, but it was not until the 1860s that the trade known as blackbirding began, the trade that would bring in the end over 60,000 kanakas, as the men were called, to cut cane in Queensland until the new federal government put an end to the system. A new book on this terrible trade has been written by the historian Ryan Butter. Blackbirding, it's called. Blackbirding, A Reckoning with the Australian Slave Trade. Just published, the book explores in particular the early years of the trade and its connection to the slave trades of both the West Indies and of Peru. Ryan joins me in the studio now. Welcome to Late Night Live.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Ryan, it all begins, doesn't it, with men from the islands working on boats. They showed that they were willing to work and to travel and that they were very good workers. Now, I'm sort of going back to the 1830s here, but it was clear to everybody really early on that there was a kind of pool of labour out there.
Correct. And I think it starts in the sandalwood industry. So that was a big industry in the 1830s. And they're using Pacific Islanders as crews on these boats. And so they're leaving Sydney and they're going out into the Pacific, they're cutting sandalwood, they're processing sandalwood, and they're selling it into China. They're using them on the whaling ships as well. And so there is this knowledge that there is this, I would say, cheap labour, because even that was exploited labour, in that they would operate on a lay system. So you would get a cut of the season's profits, and then at the end of the season, many of these Pacific Islander workers, and also Maori and First Nations, found that the costs that they'd run up were exactly equivalent to the profit they'd
strange,
made.
Strange, wasn't it?
You Very know, the, strange.
Their food and bedding costs exactly, yep. But then in the 1840s, Ben Boyd appears on the scene, and he has a much more determined plan to exploit this labour.
His plan isn't to exploit this labour initially. His plan is to exploit convict labour.
But then that runs out.
It stops just before he arrives. So he arrives in the colony of New South Wales in 1843. So there's no more convict transportation. But there is a debate. Do we start convict transportation? The free migrant system was under scrutiny because it was costing too much. And what the squatters found was when the free migrants came out, they didn't want to work. They wanted to be squatters.
Or they were no good in the bush.
or they were no good in the bush. They wanted to stay in the cities. And so the squatters wanted to bring more convicts. Now, the convicts that were already here in the working class, they didn't want to be competing with convicts. And the argument was, why would anyone come out from Britain if they're going to live next to convicts? So it was going to be who does the work. Ben Boyd had an idea to bring up, he wanted to bring up around 10,000 ticket of leave convicts from Tasmania. And he had extensive lands to work them as shepherds, and he couldn't get that. And so I hypothesise in the book, he then said, well, if I can't have the convicts, I'm going to bring black people into the colony. And for me, that was very much a scare tactic to try to provoke the government to allow him to have these convicts from Tasmania.
Yeah, I don't think people generally understand that the labour shortage in the 1830s, 40s, 50s, 60s in Australia just drove politics. Just how do we find workers? And particularly in the north, for all the promise of the tropics, nobody really wanted to work there.
No, and not only find labour, it had to be cheap labour.
Oh, yes.
And because I think they were brought up, the Australian colonists were brought up on convict labour. You couldn't get any cheaper. And so when that stops or it starts to run out, where do you turn to for this labour? And they tried all sorts of things. They tried Chinese labour, Indian labour, but for various reasons that didn't work out.
The Indians were a bit bolshy, weren't they? They would refuse to work and do all sorts of outrageous things.
But also it was the British government that was controlling the labour Britain. So to bring Indian labourers out, you had to have a migration agent at the other end, which would inform people of the contract, would translate the contract for them. You had to have certain medical supplies on board the ships. You had to have surgeons on the ships, all extra cost. And so it proved a bit too costly.
So when they began to, let's use the euphemism, recruit labour in the islands, none of those things were required, were they? Medicines, contracts, advice, none of that?
No, it was completely unregulated. So that first shipment or cargo, as it was called, of humans that Ben Boyd brought across, they arrived in Boydtown, which is down near modern-day Eden.
Where you live. Roughly where
I'm a little
live.
Bit further north.
Okay. It's okay, yeah. You're clean.
Yeah, yeah, no. I have been down there and you can go and see Ben Boyd Tower and you can have tea and scones at his house. It's all very civilised from where it came from. And he brings in 67 Pacific Islanders and they land at Boyd Town. They're near naked. They can't speak or read or write English. And they all arrive with signed work contracts, which commits them to work for Ben Boyd for 5 years, which is amazing. The Justice of the Peace refuses to sign the contracts. We can obviously see that they're a sham. And he marches these people off to the Monero. And of course, they flee.
This is Ben Boyd.
This is Ben Boyd. And they flee and they try to make their way back to Sydney to get back to their island homes.
Do they succeed?
Not many do. Some are taken back by some ships from the owned by French Jesuits, who Ben Boyd then accuses them of kidnapping his men.
Yeah.
Many hang around Sydney. It's reported that a lot of them were working on the docks. And then one unfortunate, many died. There was one known story that there was one gentleman who, as it is at Neutral Bay, and he sees the ship that brought him out in Neutral Bay. And he swims out. And he swims out to the ship and asks for passage home, and they don't let him on board. And so he makes the swim back and he drowns and he's found washed up on Neutral Bay. And it goes to court to try and work out what's happened to him, and he's one of Ben Boyd's men. That gentleman ends up in the Australian Museum on display.
So it's Towns, this man Towns, though, that begins to import to what's now become Queensland from 1859, workers to work from the islands to work. Was it originally in the forlorn attempts to grow cotton?
Correct. They were trying to grow cotton.
There was a problem with cotton, wasn't it? Because in Queensland, it rains at the wrong time of year.
Yeah, I'm not 100%.
Yeah, I think that it's
au fait with cotton production.
It's a simple weather problem, I think. The summers need to be dry for cotton and the summers in Queensland are wet. Anyway, cotton fails, sugar takes over.
Correct. But the important thing about the cotton was they were telling themselves they were growing it. in an attempt to help stop slavery in the US. It's very much connected to the US Civil War. After Abraham Lincoln blockades the South, we think, well, we will supply the cotton to Lancashire. It fails miserably. And then a couple of years later, they're using slavery to grow the cotton, which is then, by then, they've transformed the fields into sugarcane fields.
Towns has his own connection to the slave trade, doesn't he?
No. He is connected, apart from his own use of slavery in Australia. He doesn't come from a slave trading family. Benjamin Boyd comes from a slave trading family.
My mistake. It was Boyd who had... Boyd was using slave money, essentially.
His family were big into the
big
slave
slavers.
Trade. Yeah.
Yeah.
But others in Queensland, contemporaries of Towns, Lewis Hope, his family were big into the slave trade as well.
We were talking the other day on the show about the influx of slave money into Australia after the compensation payments of 1833. Out in the Pacific, ships are now, again, euphemism, recruiting workers for the sugarcane fields. How were they being recruited?
A number of ways. And it's important to stress that these Australian ships didn't just invent these ways. It came through trial and error from the Peruvian slave trade, which was started by an Australian gentleman. And so they'd worked out what worked best. And you see the techniques used in the Peruvian trade were then adopted by the people that was working for Towns.
Ryan, let's stop there for a moment. The Peruvian slave trade supplied out of the Pacific.
Correct.
By Australian traders.
By an Australian man started it. An Australian colonist, originally from Ireland. He got permission from the president of Peru to import free colonists, in scare quotes. And that kicked off a slave trade that lasted for 7 months. And it cost the lives of over 6,000 Pacific Islanders.
Who put an end to it?
The French and the British.
Ah, because they were taking men from French islands.
They were taking men from the Loyalty Islands, from the Marquesas. And so the French kicked up a diplomatic fuss. The British were a bit slow to respond. They dragged their foot. They said, well, we actually don't know which islands are protectorates of ours. But they eventually got on board. They brought a lot of diplomatic pressure. They were all returned back into the Pacific Islands. But of the 3,500 that had landed in Peru, maybe only 150, 200 survived. But those 200 that were transported back took with them smallpox.
And killed how many?
Another 3,000.
So it was in this brutal little episode that the traders worked out how you got a Melanesian, Polynesian, Micronesian man from an island to a ship. How did they do it?
So a common way was to mix rum with opium. And drug them, bring them aboard. They would lure them to look at trinkets and things on the beach, and then that happened at Easter Island, then basically just capture them. A common way that was sort of pioneered by Australian ships later on was that they would approach the island, the locals would come out in their canoes, they would drop lumps of iron, maybe small cannon, over the side, put a hole in the canoe, sink it, and then simply scoop them out of the water. And that was a common method used by Australian ships. They'd pretend to be missionaries, and they would just invite them on board and then invite them down into the hold to inspect the axes or the rifles or the tobacco, and then simply shut the hold and sail off.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Ryan Butter about his new book on the blackbirding trade. Now, Ryan, we're talking about the very first years in the 1860s, aren't we, before there was any attempt to regulate the trade at all. How did the first attempt go at trying to clean up this business at least a little?
Well, I make the point in the book that when the Queensland Parliament had a chance to outlaw the trade, they instead decided to legalise it. So Robert Towns brought the first people in 1863. The first legislation, the Polynesian Labourers Act, passed in February of 1868. And it had clauses which would sort of regulate that no one was kidnapped and you'd have to pay a bond that nobody was kidnapped, certain conditions of clothing, etc. But all of this was happening, the recruitment was happening in faraway Pacific Islands with no British presence. It wasn't like getting labour from India where there was a government that could look out for the needs or the rights of these people. There was nothing. So who knew what was going on in the recruitment? And then, of course, they all arrived at the Brisbane docks with signed labour contracts, committing them to work for 3 years. And you know, in 1867, just prior to the legislation, you know, there's newspaper advertisements advertising if you wanted to buy a man at Brisbane for £7. But that 1863 to 1868 was completely unregulated.
When a Kanaka did arrive in Brisbane, what happened then? Were they sent to employers who'd already signed up? Were they sold like slaves? What happened to them on the docks?
So there was a number of ways it could work. And again, there's advertisements from middlemen, very much like stock and station agents, and with the stock being humans. And they'd put an advertisement in, you know, the Sir Isaac Newton is sailing for the Pacific Islands. Put your order in for men. And then other times planters themselves would get amongst themselves and hire a ship and send it off. Other times people would arrive, we've arrived, we've got 200 natives, as they would say, to sell. And people would. And there's a really interesting diary I came across, Claudius Wish. He was a sugarcane planter, contemporary of Robert Towns outside of Brisbane, later a member of the Queensland Parliament. And in his diary, he talks about, oh, there's a ship come in, I'm going to go down and inspect the lads. And oh, I got a bargain. You know, I got 20 for £200 or, and it was very much like they were buying livestock.
All this time, there were citizens protesting at what was going on, were there not?
Probably from 1867 onwards. There was a gentleman called Robert Short. Now, he'd come out of the West Indies and one of the great...
He knew what he was looking at.
He knew, yeah, what slavery, well, he knew when he saw it. Because the myth at the time was this is indentured labour. And the indentured labour system itself had come in to replace slave labour when slavery was abolished in the 1830s. And so they came up with indentured labour, which gave you all the benefits of slavery without the bad look of it. And so...
Plus a wage,
a very minimal wage.
Yep. But because also, we are talking about the men brought into Australia, they were paid.
They were paid, but not often in currency. So to give you an example, Robert Towns, he appeared before a Royal Commission in 1869, held here in New South Wales.
We'll get to that, yep.
And he admitted that he never paid his people in money. And his reason was, because if I pay them in money, other nefarious settlers will rob them.
Huh. So there were people saying this is a rotten system as it flourished. Now, the terms of an indenture, that did guarantee a return to the island, didn't it?
In theory.
This was not a one-way journey.
No, in theory. So every planter had to pay £5 for every person that they brought in, and that was their return passage. But again, what guarantee they were going to the island they came from? And what guarantee that they would be alive to go home?
Separate things. What about women? Were women brought?
Very few women. So I think...
Women and families with these men?
No, because women and families were another mouth to feed, which was a cut into the profit. So I think over the 45 years of this trade, I think 10% of the estimated 60,000 were women. They were targeting young men, I'm going to say boys. So Robert Towns' instructions were to bring back 14 to 18-year-olds. Women, there was heavily regulated where these people could work. They were only allowed to work initially in sugarcane and pastoral. That later became just sugarcane, so they weren't to be used for domestic servants. And the going home, which sounds like, oh, that's a good thing, why did that come about? It came about because they didn't want to repeat the mistakes of slavery in the US, where they came and they stayed.
And a big community
and
of
a
black
large community
grew up.
They were, and they've seen the revolts in Haiti, and they've seen this agitation and the revolts in Jamaica. We don't want that happening here. And so it was a way to placate the people who really feared for the racial purity. that ridiculous notion of Australia. And so it was, yes, we have to use black labour because white people can't work in the tropics, but don't worry, we'll send them home. It's not going to, what happened in the United States isn't going to happen here. We can send them home whenever we need to send them home.
Mm. And it also has to be said, doesn't it, that one of the reasons that made Kanaka labour so appealing is that they were very good workers.
Well, they were very good workers, but even that was that sort of myth that only they could work in the tropics. And yet, David, they died by their thousands.
Yeah.
And so they were worked to death. And so I don't think, you know, I think there was racial stereotype and prejudice about how good of workers they were. You still had to feed them. You still had to water them. You still had to clothe them. And that didn't happen in a lot of cases.
I was just thinking for a moment there, sort of roll on 70 or 80 years, and it was Greeks and Italians that could work in the cane fields. Remember that?
The dark-skinned.
The dark-skinned. They
the Southerners.
Southerners. They could work in the, yeah. They could work in the cane fields. Yeah. It is on record, and it is discussed by some historians, that the Kanakas, having done their term in Australia, many of them signed up and came back again for another term. How does that fit with the notion that they were slaves?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, David. And you're correct, a lot did re-enlist. And I will say that some people came voluntarily as well, so it's not cut and dried. Re-enlistment, as proof that the conditions weren't that bad, it's an argument that's been floated since probably 1878 by the planters to show things aren't that bad. Now, at the time, people have refuted it. In 1883, George Morrison, journalist and later sort of diplomat up in China, he went on a slave return ship. His view was that one reason they re-enlist is because when they go back home, the village is no longer there, their wife is no longer there, the life they knew was no longer there, and so they re-enlist. In 1893, Robert Louis Stevenson, Treasure Island, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, he'd spent a lot of time in the Pacific. He said he'd spoken to a lot of blackbirders. His view was that a common way to get people to re-enlist was they take them from Queensland, anchor offshore from an island that's not friendly to the clan that they're from, and give them the option. Do you want us to land you here or do you want to come back to Queensland and re-enlist? So there's those. But also a really interesting insight is in 1906, when we deport them, they make a petition. Representatives of the Pacific Island community make a petition and give their reasons for not wanting to go home. And sometimes they've married women here. Yes. They've got children here. They fear that they've married a woman from the wrong clan, and when they go home, they'll be killed. So there's lots and lots of reasons why they re-enlist. Some, they might have wanted the money. They might have thought it was a good deal. But I think it's important to remember they were making a choice. The people who re-enlisted were making a choice to re-enlist. But that choice doesn't mean they had complete freedom. And you have to think that they're in a colonial power structure. We don't know how they came. We don't know what they're... They might have had three bad options, and enlisting was the best.
Mm.
So you don't know. Now, if you want to talk about the conditions on the plantations, I think how people interact with a system is a bad or a poor indicator of how good or bad the system is. But we do have testimony of what was going on the plantations. And it was pretty grim.
Let's quickly look at the geography here, because Captain Robert Townes, of course, becomes Townesville. And while the trade is moving, the trade in men is moving from Oceania, from all of the islands into Queensland, the money is in Sydney, is that right?
Correct. When I started this story, I think like a lot of Australians, I associated blackbirding with Queensland. With sugarcane, but the heart of it was in Sydney for many, many years. The men ended up in Queensland, but Robert Townes was a member of New South Wales Parliament. Ben Boyd, for a while, was a member of New South Wales Parliament. There was some French in Sydney who started an aborted slave trade to Reunion Island in 1858. They were based in Sydney. So it was all coming out of Sydney. One of the big trading firms, Burns Philp, James Burns was based in Sydney. CSR Sugar, you know, we've still got the sugar wharves here. You know, they're processing sugar grown with slave labour. Who are the shareholders? John Fairfax. In 1869, the French make a complaint to the British government that the Australian subjects are kidnapping people from the Loyalty Islands. So it's the Peruvian trade all over again.
Yeah.
They hold a Royal Commission, and they hold the Royal Commission in Sydney because the majority of the boats were owned and registered to Sydney business people.
And the Royal Commission becomes this window into the trade, but it doesn't stop the trade. What in the end stopped blackbirding?
The White Australia policy. So
simple answer. But for the White Australia policy, it would have continued?
Yeah, 100%. Because this was, they tried to stamp it out in 1892 after some really egregious atrocities, even more so than the common in the early 1880s. Griffith, the Queensland Premier, said, we're going to ban this.
Please, Sir Samuel Griffith.
Sorry, my mistake. Sir Samuel Griffith placed a ban on the trade and said, we're going to phase it out by 1892. Well, come 1890, there's a depression, sugarcane's not doing so well, the only way we can survive is with cheap labour. And so Griffith is back, Sir Samuel is back in power, and he overturns his own ban and it continues. Federation starts to bubble along, you know, driven by Sir Henry Parkes, who has no doubt and no qualms about calling this a slave trade. Edmund Barton's involved. It's a slave trade. We cannot have a federated Australia that is not racially pure. And so the other colonies saw Queensland as a back door. Again, they've got an eye on what's happened in the United States. Queensland are going to let black people into the country. And if we want federation, and we want a federation that's worth having, it must be white. And so, as you will know and your listeners will know, one of the first pieces of legislation through our federated parliament was the White Australia policy. And it took Queensland by surprise. They thought they were going to have 15 years to phase this out. And they said, nope, by 1904, no more can come. And by 1906, they're all sent home.
Well, not all, because their presence is still with us.
Correct, yeah. Correct. The idea was to send them all, but there were some carve-outs. If you'd been here before 1879, I think it was, and there were certain rules that allowed some of them to stay, but the intention was to get rid of them all if they could.
And luckily, they didn't.
Oh, it's immensely lucky. But they've tried to forget them. You know, I found an article from 1948, and it was called The Last Kanaka.
Oh, the last Tasmanian,
it was
the last Kanaka.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we can put that to bed because there's no more left. And of course, it's untrue. And it's such a vibrant, beautiful community. And I've been lucky to engage with the descendant community for pieces of writing the book. And it's, I can guarantee you, they are alive and they are well and they are fierce. And we're lucky to have that community in Australia.
Ryan, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you very much for having me.
I have been talking to Ryan Butter, who is the author of Blackbirding, A Reckoning with the Australian Slave Trade, just published. And that's the show and the week, which means it's time for Chatterbox, where we deal with your emails, letters and faxes. I'm still hoping for a fax. The number is there on our website with all the other contact details. Please, a fax. This week, we celebrated efforts to rid Kangaroo Island of cats. First the ferals, then the pets. Many commended our courage in tackling cats as the pests they are. Sandor, however, took us to task. Trying to go back to pre-Cook times is nonsense, he wrote. We fundamentally changed this continent. Now we have to learn to make it as healthy an environment as possible, which will have to include non-native predators and will sadly involve the vanishing of some native animals. Some, Sandor? This is the daily body count supplied by the Invasive Species Council for Australian cats, feral and domestic. They kill about 3 million mammals, 1.6 million reptiles, 1 million birds and 3 million invertebrates every day. Yes, every single day. My thanks, as always, to the team. Producers Catherine Zengerer, Anne Arnold, Ali Benton, and our executive producer, Jack Schmidt. Until next week.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.